welcome to another broadcast of Crime Beat with Ron Chepsik, the show that puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Crime Beat brings you a lineup of dynamic and provocative guests who allow you to experience their lives and learn more about crime. Al Proffitt, the noted crime documentarian, says, quote, Crime Beat is the best show of its kind for the thinking listener, both entertaining and educational. Let me introduce the host of Crime Beat. A native of Thunder Bay, Canada, Ron Chepsik is an award-winning author, documentary producer and director, publisher and screenwriter. He's the author of more than 36 books and 4,000 published magazine, newspaper, and internet articles. Ron is a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, was a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series, and has worked as an instructor in UCLA's Extension Journalism Program. Four of Ron's books and several of his screenplays have been optioned for movies. For more information, visit ronchepsik.com. Given his publications, extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Here he is, your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott, for that nice introduction. Good evening, world, wherever you are tonight. Well, Scott, how are you doing? It's really cold here. You know, it's like I'm burning my heat, and it's almost May, which is really unusual for South Carolina.
I have a warm, fuzzy feeling because Tucker Carlson is no longer on the air.
It made your day, right?
That's right.
Yeah, but we can't get rid of him. That's all they're talking about on TV now.
Well, the Russians are very disappointed. Lavrov was complaining.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he's about the most diabolical-looking character I've ever seen. You know, Lavrov.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Carlson.
He's right up there, too, on that bit. But, so make my day. That's right. Well, we got a great show tonight. We have Diane Margaret Moore, and we're going to be discussing her book, 16 Minutes, Was the Death of Baby Matthew an Accident or Murder? And here's the background. On the early morning of March 6, 1993, an intense fire broke out in a tiny nursery. About 16 minutes later, firefighters had extinguished the flame only to reveal a room burned so severely everything was virtually unrecognizable. Then they were told to look for a baby. What they discovered looked more like a monster from a horror film. The small skull of the baby had been incinerated, and the legs and arms were nothing more than charred stumps. The only identifiable human feature was the baby's genitals, covered in what remained of his diaper. Two people, Michelle and Matthew Wise, the newborn parents, were home at the time the fire broke out. The arson squad declared the fire suspicious, and the homeowner's insurance company hired investigators who determined the fire to indeed be arson. The prosecutor wanted to dismiss the case, but the arson unit had a newly appointed prosecutor refused to do so. Was it arson? What was the motive? Along with the tenacious and determined detective Leslie Van Buskirk, Diane Margaret Moore persisted more than 2 years to find the truth and get justice for baby Matthew Wise. It's a really fascinating story, and we'll be with Diane Margaret Moore shortly to discuss it. But first, let's take care of some business. Our acknowledgments to the people who are helping to make Crime Beat one of the most popular shows on the Internet. I'd like to thank our listeners out there from around the world for tuning in to Crime Beat. We've had more than 70 million downloads of our archive show, and we're in 160-plus countries. Listeners in those countries listen to our shows on that. And our shows are free and downloadable. You miss a live show, you go to the artistfirst.com website, listen to it. You can take our shows and post them on the web on any website. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Strategic Media Books, for supporting our show. Thanks also to production people at the Artist First Radio Network, and particularly Scott for making the show possible. And a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their great music to our theme song. It's got the beat to crime written all over it. Now let's look at the mailbag for this week. We continue to get mail from all over the world. Some comments along so we edit them for length. This email is from Frank G., who doesn't say where he's from. Here it is, Albany, New York. Frank writes, a gangster wants to be called Uncle Frank. Give me a break. Of course, he's referring to Frank Costello, the subject of Ron Fried's book, which we discussed. And Frank Costello didn't like the term Prime Minister of Crime, but he liked the term Uncle Frank, Scott.
Go figure.
I know. On that, we encourage you to continue emailing us with your comments and suggestions. You can do that at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. That's crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Tell us if you don't want to use your name. No problem. So what have you been up to? Just go to the cgmediabooks.com website. We have several books coming out, which you may find interesting. We offer affordable advertising opportunities for sponsored authors. We have several packages to meet your budget. Contact us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Now let's look at next week's show. The hits keep coming. May 11th, 2023. We will have John Wesley Anderson to discuss his book, Lou and John Benet, a legendary lawman's quest to solve child beauty queen's murder. It's an old story, John Benet story, but it's a new twist with Anderson, so it should be a really great show. Now, looking at the news for this week, we call this the rap sheet part of our program. Our rap sheet features a couple items of news that caught our attention, and you might have missed this first one here. We have a judge, and he sentenced a Pensacola, Florida man to life in prison after he was found guilty of regularly raping three children over a six-year period. Levied the life sentence on 65-year-old James Randall Moley after a jury found him guilty January 12th on six counts of custodial sexual battery of victim 12 and 18 years old and one count of lewd and lascivious molestation of a victim between 12 and 16 years old. The abuse occurred between 2008 and 2014. During the sentencing hearing, all three victims, who the local newspaper were not named to keep their identities anonymous, chose to make a statement to the court describing what Molly's disgusting actions had caused their lives. One of Molly's attorney, Barry Barrowset, told the court that Molly's wife maintains his innocence, and that's incredible that no one, quote, no one else in the house saw or heard what happened. When you look at the evidence in this case, and what you try to present is that the allegations occurred so many times, hundreds and not thousands of times, but not one person saw it. That's what Barrowset told the court. I think that's incredible. The statutory minimum sentence Kinsey could have given was 421.5 months, or just over 35 years, in state prison, but she decided to levy the maximum. Moley would also be designated as a sexual predator. This is amazing. No one saw this, and they convicted the guy. And, of course, it reminds me of that famous McMartin case, right, where you had these repressed memories, and all these kids made these accusations. And it didn't look like the people at the nursery school did it, Scott.
Yeah, that one's a mystery. But, you know, just because the wife didn't see anything happening doesn't, you know, if the kids testified it did happen, I don't know. I'd tend to think they were telling the truth.
Yeah, normally you would think that, you know, it would take a incredible amount of thought not to believe it on that then. Well, that's interesting. So we have one here. We have a MAGA supporter thinks it should be illegal for women to own dogs. That's according to the Daily Beast. In a recent bonus episode of the New Abnormal podcast, that's the title of it, hosts Daniel Moody and Andy Levy played clips of far-right politicians and supporters saying some absurd things. One clip featured a Republican state senator in Missouri advocating for marriage with 12-year-olds. Another clip, the host listened to Florida Republican Webster Barnaby compare trans people to mutants from X-Men during a hearing. Astoundingly, he also referred to transgender people as, quote, demons. Afterward, he apologized for remarks toward the transgender community. He also mocked Trump supporter Ethan Schmidt Crockett, who wants to make dog ownership illegal for single women, calling the speaker a loser. According to him, quote, you know, if a single woman owns a dog, that is a major red flag, major red flag. You know, every woman I've ever seen that's single and has a dog, especially a male dog, you know, they have no control over the dog. Going on, Schmidt Crockett argues that legislation should be passed keeping single women from owning dogs. Furthering his point, Schmidt Crockett said single women-owned dogs have attacked him multiple times. Although it doesn't need to be repeated, there's absolutely no link between sex, gender, and dog ownership competency. Perhaps Schmidt Crockett's behavior towards these dogs is what makes them aggressive, a concept that's been scientifically proven, by the way. It's also important to remember that among women and men, there are different reasons for owning a dog. According to one study, women are more likely to want a dog that gives them a sense of security and protection. During the episode, Moody and Levy, the hosts, expressed their frustration with far-right politicians and supporters making these outrageous statements. You wonder what planet these people are from, Scott.
Well, if you're worshiping the orange Jesus, you don't get to sit at the adult table anymore.
Yeah, on that then. That's it for the rap sheet part of the program. Before we continue our broadcast and begin our conversation with Ann Margenworth, let's take a station identification break. Cut.
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. All past broadcasts are podcasts. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. Now back to your host, Ronald Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott. Well, listeners, Crime Beat featured guest this evening is Diane Margaret Moore. We will be discussing her book, 16 Minutes, was the death of baby Matthew, an accident or murder. Diane became a prosecutor late in her career. As the chief arson prosecutor, she won several murder prosecutions in Marion County, Indiana, that were deemed unwinnable. Before becoming a prosecutor, Diane was a criminal defense attorney and federal public defender. Diane is now a civil litigator working for victims of plane, helicopter, train, and truck crashes. She also handles complex federal whistleblowing cases. Welcome to the show, Diane Margaret Moore.
Thank you, and I must tell you, Ron, that when I was single 34 years ago, I had dogs.
You had dogs? Oh, my God.
And they were very well behaved.
Heaven to murgatory.
Just letting you know.
You got it, buddy. Yeah, it's really crazy. Some of these people are just really out for lunch. I know. So you've got this book, and it's really interesting. How is it doing?
Well, it's not doing as well as my other book, and I think that the number of pages intimidates people, but it shouldn't, because it's about a really incredibly horrible crime. But it's from the position, obviously, of a prosecutor. And it talks about how, as a prosecutor, the things and the steps that one has to go through and, frankly, the effect of a horrible murder case on your family.
Right, right. I got to ask you, where do you find time to write? Because this book is really well researched, too. And then, of course, you're a lawyer, so you're quite busy.
Yeah, and I should tell you just very recently, Ron, that I've become the director of the Conviction Review Unit at the Prosecutor's Office in Tampa, Florida, so I'm back at criminal law. But I found the time. It was better than watching all my crime TV shows. I had to give up Perry Mason and instead write the book. And I just put aside a couple hours every night to do it, because it was important to let people know about this kind of horrible crime.
Right, right, on that then. So what do you find more challenging, being a lawyer or being a writer?
Yeah, it takes a lot more
criticism as a writer. Because I sort of envy you. I mean, I sort of hold you in awe, because I watch all those crime shows that you don't have time to watch. And, I'm amazed at the way they solve these cases.
Well, it's, being challenged, both as a writer and as a lawyer, prosecutor, defense lawyer, that's what makes life worthwhile, in my view.
Yeah.
And being able to solve some cases that people said couldn't be solved, make it even better, because you did something important, hopefully.
Right.
I mean, I'm a geezer, and so I like those thoughts.
Right. How many books have you published now?
I've got two, and one I'm working on having to do with reviewing convictions to see whether or not the folks were actually innocent. So hopefully that one will be out in the next 6 months or two or so.
Is that for a general audience, or is that specialized, that book? It sounds pretty heavy.
Well, it'll be about a lot of crimes that happened. And then the question is whether or not the person who was convicted did it, because what's most important is that we make sure we don't put innocent people in prison, but even more important, that we get people who committed these horrible crimes.
Right. Yeah, that is a problem, right? Innocent people going to jail. It seems like every day there's somebody being released after, 40 years, 30 years? Or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. By the time that the conviction integrity or conviction review units get the cases, these folks have been in prison for 20 or 30 years. And but on the other hand, the largest majority of people in prison committed the crime. So it's a small percentage, but our country says that innocent people should not be in prison. So it's a good thing that we're doing, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever represented somebody that you thought was innocent and was convicted of a crime?
Yes. As a defense lawyer, unfortunately, I did. And it was one of the reasons after that happened, I quit being a criminal lawyer for more than a decade.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. What was the case about?
It was a lawyer who was representing a drug smuggler in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And on the drug conspiracy was a huge one, and this lawyer was from Miami and had represented the drug smuggler on many cases successfully. Right. And in Indiana, on the last day of the grand jury, he cussed out the prosecutor. And so the prosecutor brought a charge against him. Two pages of grand jury testimony, and he went to trial as a co-conspirator because he was involved with these drug smugglers.
Oh,
he went
wow.
to prison for, yeah. After he got out of prison, he was actually reinstated as a lawyer, but it was horrible. It was horrible.
And there was no recourse, right?
No. His conviction was affirmed on appeal. And there was no conviction review at that point. Anyway, it made me feel terrible as a lawyer. You know, represent people always ask you, is it hard? Now, this is back when I was a defense lawyer, is it hard to represent a guilty person? Heck no, because if they get convicted, they were guilty.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to represent an innocent person.
Right, on that. We got something in common. Herschel Walker played football for University of Georgia while you were in the law library.
He certainly did.
Right? But you got to meet him. I did. So there.
Did you? When was that? At University
Back in the early 90s, I interviewed him when he was playing football for New Jersey Generals. And he was friends with Donald Trump back then. Of course,
yes.
Trump was locally known. And he actually called Herschel while I was there. You know, and I didn't mention his name, but he mentioned Donald, you know, and later on, when Trump became famous, I put together, I said, hey, that must have been Donald Trump on that. And, I interviewed him when he was still married, and he wanted to be an FBI
player.
Agent. He wanted to be an FBI agent. Yeah, and, you know, and he ran for office, of course. He lost.
Yes.
On that, then.
So, I'm not going to comment on that.
On that, then. So before we move on to the book, what advice would you give to somebody that's working hard like you during the day and wants to be a writer?
Oh, I think that if you have a story that you need to tell, then sit down and put it to words, and then get someone who is critical of you to review it, to help you edit it. It was so worthwhile, and it really feels good. What doesn't feel good is some of the, you know, when you get reviews and they say, that's a little disturbing.
Right.
But at least in my case, I've been very fortunate. Most of them have been pretty good.
Right. Did you think developing a hard shell as a lawyer helps you as a writer? Because you get a lot of rejection. I mean, everybody has it.
Yeah, I didn't realize. I think what most people believe is that the hard part is writing. That's not the case, in my opinion. If you know your story, writing it comes pretty easily. Getting someone to publish it and read it, that's a whole other story.
Right.
And so I'm very fortunate to have, you know, a wonderful publisher that read my stuff and like it. And both 16 Minutes was The Death of Baby Matthew, An Accident or Murder.
Yes.
And my other book are both on audio. So it's funny, friends of mine say, even though they're listening to someone else's voice, they hear me through the book.
Yeah, exactly on that. Well, this story, 16 Minutes, it sounds like a simple story about a tragedy. What attracted you to it and decide that it was worth a book?
Well, the case, arson cases are not simple. 16 minutes is about a fire that happens in a small home.
Right.
Only the nursery was burned and an 8-week-old child was killed. So arson, unlike other murders, I mean, if someone is shot in a parking lot, it's very clear that a murder occurred and you're really just looking for who did it.
Yeah.
In an arson case, first you have to prove that the fire was caused not by an accidental cause,
mm-hmm.
and that can be very difficult. In this case, the claim was that a baby monitor had started the fire.
Right.
And so dealing with learning all about this particular model of baby monitor and dealing with engineers. So first it was a matter of proving it's not an accident, then proving that it was intentional and who caused it.
Right.
And those are what you need to do in these kind of cases. So,
right.
And then in this particular case, we had experts who didn't agree with each other. Which also makes it a little bit challenging.
Yeah,
But the real issue is, before I finished the book, I went to the cemetery where this baby was buried.
Right.
And it was a really, I'd never done that before. You know, prosecutors normally don't follow up after the case. And when I went to the cemetery, the burial site had never been visited after the day of the burial. Speaking with the gentleman who ran the cemetery, and you could tell, I mean, it was dirty. Other ones had flowers and teddy bears, and this had nothing. The parents didn't care enough, or grandparents, to even visit this child's place of death. So that told me that people needed to know about him and care about him.
Right. On that. Well, tell us a little bit about the parents, Matthew and Michael. I think they were married in July, 1992, and something like 2 months after they were after that, they learned that Michelle was pregnant with Matthew's child, right?
Yes, and well, the father's name was William Wise.
Yeah, excuse me, he William, right?
No, that's fine. Baby yeah. Matthew was the baby, and yes, and what came out in trial is that William Wise did not want to have a child. Michelle had actually gotten pregnant once before and had been convinced to have an abortion. In the meantime, they broke up, and William Wise was dating a teenager, almost 10 years younger than him, who became pregnant with twins, and she was killed. She was murdered, and he was the last person to see her. So all of these facts added up to, who is this guy?
Right.
And Van Buskirk, you mentioned her. Van Buskirk is this incredible detective.
Right.
As we looked into it, it turned out that William Wise, the father, actually had firefighter training. He worked for the fire department in Indianapolis,
right.
Although as a dispatcher, and knew a lot about fires.
Yeah.
So first proving that it was arson, then how did the arson occur?
Mm-hmm.
And then figuring out, since mom and dad were both there,
right?
Who killed him?
Yeah. Well, there were only two people there, right, at the house.
Only two.
Yeah.
Only two.
On that, and it's really interesting because the insurance company came in and they pretty quickly decided that, hey, this was arson, right?
Absolutely. Well, the reason that the book is called 16 Minutes
because
is because. Exactly, because between the time the fire started and when the firefighters had it completely out was only 16 minutes, and yet there was nothing left in the room more than 3 inches above the ground.
Yeah.
And the firefighters walked in and said, no, this could not happen unless it was an intentionally set fire.
Yeah, on that. I think the hard part, I think, is accepting the fact that somebody could be a monster like this and do that to the baby, right, in terms of deciding whether he's innocent or guilty. I mean, it would be hard to believe that a father can do this to his own child.
Unbelievable. How on earth can a parent, I mean, a parent killing their child is one thing that's pretty horrible in itself, but to kill an awake, alive child by fire is unbelievable.
Yeah, and especially when you realize what happened to the baby. I mean, the actual body, you know, the body is just awful on that. So where does Michelle fit into all this?
I mean, well,
she wasn't convicted or anything, but I mean, she seems like the missing link in this story.
Oh, I don't doubt it. I mean, one of the issues really was, and I'll tell you why, because when the fire started, these people did have a fire alarm in the house.
Right.
And instead of, in any event, running and getting your baby, Michelle ran downstairs, tried to turn off the alarm, came back upstairs, ran back again to get shoes and clothes on, and left the house to go to a neighbor's house to make a phone call.
But she never mentioned anything about the baby, right?
Never when she called 911,
she didn't react like a mother would. Hysterical, screaming, you know, save my baby and all that. None of that went on.
No. I mean, why didn't she go save the baby?
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, her excuse was, and now she's remarried, and as I said, apparently never even visits the grave, which is, I don't know how you do that. Yeah. But no, what happened was that there just wasn't enough evidence, and at one point against her. At one point, it seemed like William Wise's lawyers were trying to point the finger at her.
Oh, wow.
She's still out there.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no statute of limitations on murder.
Right, on that. Well, it's interesting because in defense of William Wise, I mean, there was no life insurance on the son, so there was no monetary motive, right? For one thing.
There was a monetary motive, but we didn't find it out until...
what was the monetary motive?
Weighs in. He blamed the fire on a baby monitor from a major company, and right after the fire was at a party and asked a cousin who was a lawyer whether she thought that there was a case.
Right. Oh, wow, she was going to sue them.
Yes, and right before we charged him, he filed a lawsuit against this company asking for $2 million, which was a lot of money then.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a lot of money now, but and one of the things to track down was, how did he find out to blame the baby monitor? And so, again, when you've got a phenomenal... support group and detectives. So we tracked down that a show about a baby monitor fire had been seen in Indianapolis a couple months before baby Matthew died.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, that wasn't something we were able to admit at trial, but I just wanted to know, how'd this guy come up with this scheme? So you're right. He was smart enough to know that an insurance policy, a life insurance policy, would be problematic, but not a lawsuit against a baby monitor company.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I mean, the house was lost in the fire and all that, but the house was mortgaged. I mean, and, you know, they would have had to pay off the money anyways. So it didn't make sense. I mean, the monetary part of it didn't make any sense, you know?
Well, so they'd only been in the house for a couple of months.
Right.
And you talked about the insurance company. The insurance company knew from the beginning, again, with the 16 minutes, they believed that the fire was intentional. And so while they had to pay off the mortgage, which was the largest part of it. And actually, the whole house didn't burn down, so it was a smaller amount. But they went and did a reenactment of the whole thing to try and prove to themselves.
Right? Hesburn, I think they call it.
Yes, they did. Yeah. But they not only did the burn, but they built an identical room and put similar things in the room to see how long it would take to really burn to the level that it was on that day.
That's interesting because, you know, a test burn, from what I understand, is pretty costly. So they were, I mean, they were tenacious in their attempt to prove arson, even though, I mean, it didn't make any sense financially to the company.
It did not, and I
mean,
have
you
to
figure
say,
all the hours that they spent, you know, reconstructing the house and all that, and they had to bring the investigators down. Well, why were they so obsessed with proving that this was arson?
The adjuster was apparent.
Oh.
That's all I can say. There was there was no financial motive. He wanted to know the truth, and he convinced his insurance company, which in this case was Allstate, to go to one of the best engineering firms in Indiana. And they had both an electrical engineer and a fire arson cause and origin person. And they built this room, they burned it, they recorded that, and that was some of the best evidence we had at trial. Honestly, without that video, I don't know that we could have won this case.
Right. We'll talk about the case and we'll talk about your involvement after we take a break here. This concludes the first part of our show tonight. Scott, let's take a break and run a few commercials and we'll be back.
Hi, I'm James Baller of Artist First Radio, and I would like to tell you about a fascinating new book from Crime Beat's Ron Chepsik and co-author Mike Rowe. It's titled Robin Hood of the Hood, The Life and Times of Teddy Rowe, Policy Kingpin, and it's published by Strategic Media Books. The book is a historical account of Theodore Teddy Rowe, who courageously fought the Chicago Mafia, more commonly known as the Outfit, for control of the lucrative policy racket in the Windy City. Policy, often called the numbers, is a form of illegal gambling or illegal lottery, played mostly in poor and working-class neighborhoods in the United States. In Policy, a bettor attempts to pick three digits to match those that will be randomly drawn the following day. For decades, Policy had been a staple in the black community, but when the white mob flexed its power in the late 1940s, many Policy kings knuckled under the pressure. Not Teddy Rowe. Rowe famously told mob bosses that he'd rather die than give up control of his operation. Robin Hood of the Hood chronicles an exciting chapter of Chicago history. Go to the Kindle store at Amazon and buy it for just $2.99. For information about this book and other titles, please go to strategicmediabooks.com. That's strategicmediabooks.com.
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. All past broadcasts, our podcasts, pick them up at artistfirst.com. Back to your host, Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott. We're here with Diane Margamore, and we're discussing her book, 16 Minutes. It's a story about a tragic case of a baby dying in a fire on that. And the book is available everywhere, Diane?
Everywhere, yes.
On that,
it is.
Then? Yeah, and has the audio book come out?
It is. It's in book form, Kindle, and audio.
Yeah, and isn't a publisher? We both got the same publisher. I got a book coming out in July, Wild Blue. They're really great, right? The audiobook, I mean, you usually have to pull teeth with a publisher to get it out, and they get it out right away.
They're wonderful. They really are, and they're knowledgeable and help a great deal with editing, and I really do like their voice actors. So, yes.
Right.
A lot of people like to listen as they're driving. So
yeah, exactly. It's people are really busy nowadays, and that really helps, including yours truly here. So I enjoy that. On that said, but as far as you're concerned, you're active on social media.
Not as much as I should be, and part of that is because I work full time. But
right. So you're not on Facebook?
You don't have a big presence on Facebook. I don't have a big presence on Facebook, but I am there. And there's, you know, Amazon has an author's section right. where you can ask questions, and so does Wild Blue. And
right.
I'm really glad to respond to any questions that anybody asks me. So, no, I'm not as active as I
right.
should be, but I will respond.
Right. I would imagine you don't have a website.
I don't.
Okay.
I get admonished for that a lot. So
how about
okay,
Twitter?
You've been heard.
Yeah, okay.
No.
How about Twitter?
No Twitter.
No Twitter, limited on Facebook. You got to dance on TikTok, right?
Now, you did notice from the age thing how old I am, right?
No, you're young at heart, so.
Uh-huh, that's, at heart I am.
Yeah, on that then, that's okay. I mean, your energy level's high, so it's hard to tell your age on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome on that then. And can we see you on YouTube in action?
I hope not. If it's there, it's been posted by one of my children.
On that then. Okay, that sounds great. Well, getting back to the book, 16 Minutes, I'm just curious, what was his motive for doing this? He just hated the baby. I mean, he never had the baby, just for a couple of months. They could have had an abortion. You know, when the baby was born, they could have, you know, put up for adoption or whatever. I mean, why did you have to go through this incredibly gory, scene of the killing this poor child?
Well, we talked about the money motive from suing the baby monitor company,
yeah.
but I really think that there was a much more basic. So this guy is a firefighter wannabe.
Right.
And when he came back to Indianapolis, they wouldn't allow him to be a firefighter. He was a dispatcher.
Right.
He told a woman that he'd been dating before he got married, and we had to imagine trying to find somebody who dated him. Anyway,
yeah.
we found her. She said that he always kept a fire jacket and a fire hat in the back of his car because his goal in life was to rescue somebody, and then the Indianapolis Fire Department would have to bring him on as a firefighter. And so in this case, he pretended that he was trying to save baby Matthew.
That is really, that's crazy.
That's sick, right?
I know, it really is on that then. And of course, you know, he maintained his innocence, right? I mean.
Oh, yes. Absolutely, but he never.
And the wife, what did she do under questioning? How did she react?
She stood by him. I mean, there came a point that when his lawyers were essentially accusing her of having been responsible. Van Buskirk and I drove up to Elkhart, Indiana, which is where she
right.
lived, and met with her and
right.
said, you know, what are you doing? You know,
yeah.
what really happened? And she was, I don't know. She gave me bad feelings. But
right.
again, he was the one who was the most obvious, since he
right.
had remained in the house and said he was going to save the baby. Do I still have an inkling that she had to have, either she was, you know, just totally out of it emotionally, but this was the first night that he'd ever stayed up with the baby. He was upstairs. She was downstairs when the
yeah.
fire started. There's just too much to suggest that he was the primary.
Yeah.
But as I suggest in the book, I still have my doubts about whether she should have been prosecuted.
Right, right. She may have gotten off with the skin of her teeth on this thing here. But it's a good time to introduce Leslie Busker. Who is she? She was a detective, right?
She still is a detective.
I know.
So
she sounds like a salty woman.
Oh, my God. Leslie Van Buskirk is, she was a ballerina in a former life. I mean, was a ballet student.
How did you become a prosecutor, from going from ballerina to prosecutor?
No, a detective.
A detective. That's really a wild transformation.
And do you know that ballerinas walk a certain way? It's a glide almost.
Yeah.
And so she has this presence, and very thin, attractive woman. And when she opened her mouth, she made a sailor blush. I mean, she told me words and sayings and thoughts that I had never, I had never heard. I guess I was more innocent than I thought at more than 40 years old. But Van Buskirk was tenacious. She just would not give up on this case. And
she was obsessed with it because of the circumstances, right? The young baby.
Yes, and because of the fact that she knew it was a murder, she felt it was a murder, and that this guy was going to slide. In fact, the prosecutor's office didn't want to prosecute him, let him out on bond. He'd been on bond. I mean, no one gets bond in a murder case.
Yeah.
He was charged with murder. He had highly political trial lawyers in the first instance.
What do you mean by highly political?
Well, the law firm that was representing him was very, very powerful in the Democratic Party. And
where did he get the money to hire them?
I don't know. I suspect that it was, where did he get the money to hire them?
Yeah.
That's a really good question, because I can tell you they don't come cheap.
Yeah,
and they didn't come cheap then.
What would they, if they're political, they're obviously looking for a political angle on the story. What would they see as political helping them?
Well, the prosecutor at the time was the prosecutor who had been in the office.
Right.
And had just gotten out of the office, was running for attorney general as a Democrat. And these lawyers were very powerful in the Democratic Party. There was also a suggestion at one point, and I don't know that it's true or not. I think Van Buskirk believed it, that the prosecutor who was trying to, I mean, the assistant prosecutor, we called them deputy prosecutors at the time, was looking to get a job with that firm. I don't know that that's true. But there are a number of reasons, but the most likely reason is that no prosecutor likes losing, especially a high-profile case, and they had questions about whether they could really win this case.
Right.
So
that's true. That's an argument, it's understandable.
Yeah. So, arson cases frequently do not get tried because they're always circumstantial.
Right.
And when you have an arson murder, it's obviously circumstantial unless the person gets burned in the fire.
Right.
And so they're afraid of them.
Right. So what changed their mind? Why did they decide finally that this deserved a trial for murder?
They didn't. They were getting ready to dismiss it, and when I found out about it through the second in command in the office, because it had to be signed off on by him, we had a meeting, and I said there was no way I would dismiss it.
Right.
I didn't guarantee I would try it, but I want to investigate. And Van Buskirk and I spent about another 2 years investigating, putting a case together. And it's one of the things that the public doesn't like, in many cases, and I'll compare it to, what happened with OJ. If you rush to trial on a circumstantial case without building all of the evidence, just because the public demands it, then you can lose. And so we needed to take the time to put the evidence together.
So what was the evidence that turned the tide in favor of a conviction?
I want people to read the book. But okay.
Yeah, true. Well, just give us a hint. Give us a hint.
So
I think they're going to I think you're going to read it now because it's really compelling.
Well, thank you, Ron. there were several things that one would never have thought of. Of course, there was the time. The second thing was learning about the lawsuit against the baby monitor company. Then what we did is we had to, we used, 25 or 30 of these baby monitors trying to find out if they could cause a fire. So we had essentially people doing work for the prosecutor's office at no charge to us because we didn't have a budget for engineers and fire cause and origin.
It cost a fortune.
Oh my gosh. And then the very last piece of evidence had to do with the medical examiner's testimony.
Right.
Because at one point in the trial, one of the lawyers, because there was a claim that the medical examiner concluded that gasoline had actually been poured on baby Matthew and that was the reason he was incinerated. And so the question was, why was that little piece of diaper and his genitals still not burned up? And the answer is that when you pour a liquid substance, you know, for the time that it's liquid, it actually protects that area. And so one of the defense lawyers took an 8-track video, put a little baby diaper on it, he didn't have kids, and poured water on it to show that the water wouldn't go in the diaper. Was not. Anyway, so we showed, of course, that, yes, that's what happens. And go ahead.
I was going to say, were you concerned that maybe the jury would not buy this? I mean, it's so incredible that a parent would go through all this to kill a little kid that, you know, they would say, no, I don't believe it.
And absolutely.
Just dismiss the charges.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, more and more now, I'd say in the last 20 years, we have more and more parental killings, but it started with Susan Smith. Do you remember her?
Yeah.
She had those.
Well, she's right down the street, right down the
really?
Yeah, it's about 50 miles from where. Well, I still remember the scene. It's like remembering when Kennedy got shot, you know?
Of course.
I heard the story. I couldn't believe it. You know, she drove the car into the water and all this, and said, oh, how horrible.
She had these three beautiful little boys, and when you saw their picture, these were these blonde, cherub little guys. And
exactly.
She gets on the news and says, I would never hurt them. And
she was crying on the news, and I remember that.
Crying, and it wasn't until she was convicted, which was years after my case, that jurors could consider the fact that people murder their baby. And so, yes, you have to prove to them back then, and I think still now, there's still a reluctance, especially parents who love their children.
Yeah.
Find it really hard to believe that a parent could do such a thing. And in the case of Michelle, that she could, if she didn't do it, that she could let him do that.
Yeah.
You know, by leaving the house and not getting the baby herself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to stop there. This will finish the second part of this amazing show. And we'll take a break, run a few commercials, and come back again, Scott, for the conclusion.
Crime Beat host Ron Chepsik's new book, The Real Mr. Big, How a Colombian Refugee Became the United Kingdom's Most Notorious Cocaine Kingpin. It's the story of an ambitious Colombian refugee who immigrated to the United Kingdom and set up a sophisticated drug trafficking organization that the British Secret Service MI5 claims made more than £1 billion over a 10-year period. That made him the UK's first billionaire cocaine dealer. Ruiz Henao's impact on the British economy was such that the price of cocaine increased 50% for several months after his arrest. British law enforcement dubbed him the Pablo Escobar of British drug trafficking. Go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble to buy your copy of Ron Chepsik's The Real Mr. Big, How a Colombian Refugee Became the United Kingdom's Most Notorious Cocaine Kingpin. You will enjoy it. And after you do, don't forget to leave a review.
Hey, this is Barbara Brandline. Check out my new book, Olive, now available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at your favorite local bookstore. You are listening to Artist First Radio Network.
Listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. Send us your questions and comments to crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Back to your host, Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott. We're here with Dan Wagamore. We're discussing your amazing book, 16 Minutes. It's about the death of a young baby and the investigation that followed. The book is available everywhere. There's an audio book, if you like listening to books while you drive. This would be a great book for doing that. And Diane is not very active on social media, and she doesn't dance on TikTok, and you can't see her on YouTube. So on that, but anyways, the story. What happened at the trial when the jury went out? What was your feeling? Did you think that you had him, or did you think that maybe that you lost it?
Well, you never really know.
Right.
And so I thought that because of all of the evidence and the time it had taken, that it would take the jury a long time to come back.
Right.
I actually left the courthouse with Van Buskirk. We went to a restaurant to have lunch, and as soon as we sat down at the table, the jury was back.
That quickly. So what did
that quickly.
Tell you? Innocent or guilty when they come back that
you
quickly?
Know? If I had ESP, I could be a super prosecutor.
Right.
So it's really hard to tell. In
yeah.
some cases, you want them to come back fast.
Yeah.
And in some cases, you wonder about the what they're doing back there.
Right.
But in this case, I think they were well persuaded. And by the time that we got to that final verdict, there was a lot of evidence that was those building blocks that you get to in a circumstantial case.
Right. Right.
So, are you kidding? I loved my jurors.
Yeah. Well, they threw the book at him because he was sentenced to consecutive terms of 60 years for murder and 50 years for arson.
Yeah.
So
the judge, it's very interesting because the defense argued that, you know, he'd done all these good things, and
yeah.
the judge, Jane Magnus Stinson, who went on to become a federal judge and then chief federal judge
yeah.
in Indianapolis, she just laid into them. I mean, the truth was that I think she saw it the way we did, is this
right.
is a man who murdered an eight-week-old child for what? To get on the fire department or to win money?
Right.
So I thought his sentences were appropriate.
Right.
Unfortunately, in Indiana at the time, there was still parole availability, and he didn't get life without parole.
Right, right. Well, he's not going down without a fight. He's appealing. So what are his chances of winning his appeal?
Oh, no, that was long ago, and the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court affirmed his conviction, so
right.
he has no further appeals.
Right, and he's never confessed to the thing.
No.
Right.
I would never expect him to confess. He did things that we know that arsonists do. He set little fires when he was a child. He stole a fire truck because he thought it would be fun.
Right.
He did, you know, so he's got the things in his history that suggest that he's got some issues. I don't think his time in jail will have cured him from those.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't a case like this make you think about mankind? I mean, how frightening,
you know, it is.
Our species can be.
It is really of concern. And when people read the kind of books that we write, it's
right.
not, at least in my instance, it's not to confirm that mankind is horrible. It is
right.
to confirm that we have a choice and that some people choose to be evil and some of us don't.
Yeah, on that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of evil people around.
You know, I haven't decided if they're more and more or if we're just learning about it because of the internet and the availability of news and things like that.
Right.
I just don't know.
Right. Well, we've got just about a minute left. What are you working on now?
Conviction review and talking about how it occurs that even though our system is, in my opinion, the greatest one anywhere,
right.
our jury system,
right.
that innocent people can still be convicted. And
right.
So hopefully people will look at some of these cases. And I'm also going to talk about some of the cases that people sought conviction review that weren't entitled to it.
Well, good luck with the project, and it's been a real pleasure having you on the show tonight. We hope to get you back on. When you finish the book, let us know. We get you back on to discuss it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, that sounds great on that. I really enjoyed it myself. Thank you. Have a great evening, Diane.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, listeners, that was a really interesting show. Just a reminder for all you out there, the next program is scheduled for April 27th. We'll have Patty McCracken discuss her book, Angel Maker, Arsenic, Midwife, and Modern History's Most Astonishing Murder Ring. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network. Where we are tonight, I'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our show. And until next week, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you'll want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Sleep tight, everybody.